Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Mac Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where Y is for You Only Live Twice, the fifth James Bond film starring Sean Connery as 007. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me as we hop aboard Blofeld's monorail and take a trip to Japan, he's just graduated from ninja training school, it's Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Ah, hello.
We're also going to be dropping in a special guest in this episode, the writer of the cinematic Connery, Mr. AJ Black, who'll be joining us at certain points to add some context to Connery's history with the film. With this episode, we will have wrapped up our 27th and final James Bond film special. If you're listening in chronological order, obviously this is the fifth one. So, and talking about listening in chronological order, if you want to listen back to all of our episodes about the films, there is a playlist on Spotify, which has been put in chronological order. You can find that link on our link tree. So, if you want to go back and listen to them in the order that they were made in, then can do that. So if you are listening in chronological order, you'll notice that the release date of You Only Live Twice, 1967, means that this is the first time in Bond history that fans had to wait for more than a year for the next fix of 007. That's kind of crazy to think about now, isn't it?
It is, yeah, considering, yeah. You know, we have to wait the span of all of those films for another one.
Yeah, Dr. No from Russia with Love, Goldfinger and Thunderball were all released over four consecutive years, but You Only Live Twice came out a full 18 months after Thunderball, and we'll talk about why in a minute. And so coming after Thunderball, the original plan was to make On Her Majesty's Secret Service as the next film, but to keep Sean Connery happy and to avoid having to shoot early 1966, the producers opted to make You Only Live Twice. They obviously, to shoot that later in the summer, there was going to be no snow if they were to shoot in summer. So On Her Majesty's Secret Service was backburnered, and they made You Only Live Twice instead. So before we dive into the story of the film, here's a quick synopsis. A disaster in space pushes humankind towards World War III, and only James Bond can prevent it in this action-packed movie spectacular. When US and Soviet spaceships are hijacked in Earth's orbit, 007 must race to prevent a nuclear war between the two superpowers. His dangerous mission takes him to Japan, where he must stop the Spectre organization and its diabolical leader, Ernst Stavro Blofeld, hidden away in a massive headquarters in an inactive volcano. I have to say, on paper, that sounds awesome.
It does. Not only on paper.
It? Yeah, you're a big fan of this one, aren't you?
Yeah, but only a recent new fan to it, really. I think when we started, and if you go back and listen, then there'll be people who are listening to the early episodes, I don't think we showed much love for it at all. I think all three of us, maybe Wheatley was probably most on board with this one early on.
Yeah, maybe. I've definitely come around to it a lot more, having watched it a lot over the last year in the cinema and at home. Just think it's a rollicking adventure. There are stupid things with it, but what Bond film doesn't have stupid bits to it? But let's dive straight into it. Let's stop beating around the bush. 1967, Brendan, tell us about the year this movie came out.
Okay, so 1967, there's a lot of stuff going on. In terms of films, though, I'll just start off with that. So some quite iconic films from this year. To Sir With Love, The Dirty Dozen, Bonnie and Clyde, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, The Graduate. Those sort of films, they're very heavy, I would say.
Yeah.
So much needed that You Only Live Twice comes and... with its nonsense. But other stuff that happened in 67, this was the first colour TV broadcast was made in the UK on BBC
Interesting.
Two.
Interesting.
So yeah, that was Wimbledon Championships with the first colour coverage.
Green.
Green, yeah. They probably mastered green at that. Sergeant Pepper's was released.
Yes.
Which, if you remember when we interviewed John Higgs, Love and Let Die, he wrote that about the parallels. And this is another parallel, really, because this is their first concept album.
Right.
And if you look at You Only Live Twice, it's just bonkers, isn't it? It's a concept Bond movie, really. And it was the first album released, obviously, after they stopped touring. And this is the first one that's released after Connery decides he doesn't want to do Bond anymore. So, which we'll go into. But obviously at this point, 1967, this film is being released on the back of Bond Mania and Spy Mania, which was absolutely huge. Thunderball was still smashing box office records in April 66. And at that point, there were the first murmurings of unrest at Eon. If you remember, we spoke about this in the Broccoli episode, the Saltzman episode, and probably the Eon episode. So this is where they came to that, the separation deal, where they agreed that they came up with the arrangement where they would rotate who produced which picture. So,
and this is a cubby one, right? Because it's an outlandish...
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So picture, he takes the producing reins for this one. And he said that... Well, he acknowledged how this had come about, and he said, "I knew that Harry Saltzman and I wouldn't be able to conceal our own disagreements much longer. It wasn't just a conflict of personalities. While other partnerships have survived, it was, at least the way I saw it, two totally contrasting attitudes to Bond. And we see that from the films that they make. So this one, You Only Live Twice, nonsensical. The following one, Under Majesty's, is grounded. Diamonds Are Forever, nonsensical. Live and Let Die, a bit more grounded. And then...
But with Papa Shango. Not Papa Shango. Baron Samedi. With Baron... You know what I meant.
With Baron Samedi, yes. And then the last one before they have Harry leaves, but Cubby, just the man with the golden gun. So yeah, this is the start of that. That's one thing that's obviously hectic.
Yeah.
Not only that, another Bond movie has been announced, which obviously is not ideal. It's Casino Royale. Go back to Casino Royale episode for that, for more nonsensical. That is off the map, that one.
Yeah.
So this one was announced obviously around that time of the sort of ongoings at Eon. So they had that to deal with, and then they had this to deal with. But Casino Royale was released in the same year as well. So in April 67, a few months before You Only Live Twice. So this was one of the first Battle of the Bonds. And obviously we covered it in the episode, but it cost an eye-watering amount. And Charles K. Feldman, it was the last film he ever made.
Basically killed him, didn't it?
Yeah, the stress, the difficulties on set, off set, you know, it's... Yeah, do go back and listen to it because it's fascinating. Not only that, Operation Kid Brother, 1967, which we talked about in the Connery episode, but it starred Sean Connery's younger brother, Neil, and he played essentially a Bond ripoff. It was Italian, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And so that did nothing for Connery's feeling towards playing Bond either. And not only that, it in the casting that you had Adolfo Celli, Daniela Bianchi, Bernard Lee, Anthony Dawson, and Lois Maxwell. And obviously Sean was absolutely fuming especially at Lois Maxwell and Bernard Lee. Bernard Lee told him, he said, "I told him that I was making more money in that one film that I'd made in all the official Bond films put together." I mean, surely a man like Connery would understand. You know? And then outside of the film world, we had the space race, which heavily influenced the story of this film, what was going on at the time. So in March 1965, the first spacewalk ever was performed by Alexei Leonov. And then later on in March, the US launched their first multi-person US spacecraft, Gemini 3, with Virgil Grissom and John Young. So obviously this is very much in everyone's thoughts at the time. Yeah. With that race to eventually get into the moon, I guess, is what they're aiming for. And then June 65, the first American did a spacewalk and Gemini 4. And then we move forward to March 1966. There was the first docking in space, and Neil Armstrong was on Gemini 8 for that one. So this being constantly in the news and talked about, it meant that the writers, the producers, you know, they would implement it.
Yeah,
because that's what Bond has always done, and it was a very exciting. I mean, it's hard to imagine now, isn't it? I mean, space, going to space is still exciting. However, then it must be absolutely mind blowing.
What, you, they don't even have colour TV. I mean, that's the first colour TV, exactly. And yet people are in space. Mm. And there's two countries who are at Cold War with each other racing to do this. I mean, it's just like the drama is real, right? That's reflected in You Only Live Twice. It opens with a huge space sequence. The poster shows Bond holding a space helmet. Yeah. They're sort of signposting it. This is a space race movie, aren't they? Way before, you know, Moonraker jumped the shark and shot Bond into space. They tease you with space all the way through this movie. It's a big, big part of it.
Welcome, Honourable 007. He's the one and only Sean Connery.
Welcome to Japan, Mr. Bond.
Shall we go into pre-production then?
Yeah.
So, at the Japanese premiere of Thunderball in 65, Cubby Broccoli announced that Lewis Gilbert was going to be the director of the next James Bond film. Now, he was a British filmmaker, known to be very, very reliable. He'd served in the RAF during World War II, made a lot of military films. And when he came out of the service, made more military films, including Sink the Bismarck, The Sea Shall Not Have Them, Reach for the Sky, Albert RN, Carve a Name with Pride. These are all big sort of military epics, and you can see the military side coming through in his movies, right? In this one and in The Spy Who Loved Me, there's Bond in the naval outfit. There's a lot of naval iconography in the movie, so Lewis Gilbert brings some of that to Bond. He was massive at the time in 1967, riding on the success of Alfie, his adaptation of the Bill Norton novel and play of the same name, starring Michael Caine, that had earned 5 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, which is kind of crazy. And Alfie, if you've never seen it, well worth seeing. Not the remake, though. So when Lewis Gilbert was initially approached by Cubby and Harry, he turned it down. He said he felt he had nothing new to add to the series. But Cubby called him a second time on the next day, famously telling him, "You're making a mistake. You have the world's biggest audience, and it's waiting to see what kind of a hash you make of it." So he's kind of putting him on the spot there. But Lewis Gilbert, talking about it later, he said that directing a Bond film was actually a lot easier than you think. Because basically everything is lined up for the director to basically just point the camera and start shooting. He says you've got the sets, the locations, the actors, the stunts. And he said it's like being a general in charge of an army. So you just point them in the right direction and say go. He said that the hardest scenes he felt to direct were when it was just 4 people sitting around a table in conversation, because you had to make that interesting somehow. Directing Bond was easy for Lewis, because everything was already on camera, was already interesting already. So you just set them off and that was it. So, and talking about working with Lewis Gilbert, the film screenwriter Roald Dahl, who we'll talk about in a second, said that Lewis is the only director I ever worked with who is any kind of a decent fellow. He was absolutely splendid. He said that Lewis Gilbert was always giving really good contributions in script meetings. He was also very faithful to the script when he shot it, which for a writer is all that you can ask for. And he felt that Lewis Gilbert never let his ego get in the way of getting the script on film, which actually is quite good. He said you either trust your writer or you don't. So a filmmaker who really understood the power of the written word. By all accounts, I know that Roger Moore really enjoyed working with Lewis Gilbert as well. And in fact, I would say he's probably my favourite of the Bond directors. As a personal preference, but that's the director. Who have we got writing the script? I've just name dropped him already, but
yeah, spoilers. Well, Richard Maybaum was unavailable for this one. So November 1965, they announced that Sidney Bohm is working on it, and he delivered a treatment which was closely based on the novel. But then Harold Bloom, who we spoke about many, many episodes ago, and he had worked on an episode of Captain Gallant of the Foreign Legion, which was a TV show that Harry Saltzman produced. So they'd got him on board, and he took over the writing efforts. And he'd used the skeleton of the treatment that Sidney Bohm had created, and he added to that. And he delivered a draft screenplay in February 66. But Cubby Broccoli said it didn't really work. And so Bloom left, and they got Roald Dahl on board. Dahl had known Fleming for about 20 years prior to this.
Through espionage, wasn't it, in World War II?
Mm. And he talked about him. He said there was a great red glow when Ian Fleming came into the room. And he described Fleming as sparky, witty, caustic companion, full of jokes and also full of obscure bits of knowledge. But in terms of You Only Live Twice, Dahl wasn't a fan of the novel. He said it was tired, bad, and Ian's worst book. So
it's one of the late ones, isn't it?
It was the last one published while he was alive.
Right.
Yeah, so it's definitely towards the end.
And it's the mad one with the Blofeld and the Poison Island and the knight, the suits of armour and stuff, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Which, this is the first one to stray away from the novels. So yeah. There's not much in there that you will find that translates across to the film. Roald Dahl didn't initially want to do it, though. He said, if you've got enough money to live comfortably, there's no reason in the world to do a screenplay. It's an awful job. But he did need the money, and that's why he took it on eventually. So, he got a call from Cubby Broccoli, and he said he hadn't heard of him, which I find remarkable. If you think, the height of the mania where we're at, you think you would have. He said, a man with the last name of a vegetable. Yeah, that's how you base your opinions on people. He was also wasn't a Bond fan, Roald Dahl. He'd only seen Goldfinger. And so the producers said that you better watch the others right away. So they sent him a projector and someone to work it. So he had all the films. But this meant he knew the sort of level of producer he was working with. They were so efficient, so quick to get everything sorted. And just the way they threw money at everything, as we've seen throughout the whole franchise. The producers, they struck the deal with Dahl's agent. And the terms were completely agreed. And he started working with Lewis Gilbert. And Lewis Gilbert said, Roald is an interesting writer for a Bond film. He's a bit quirky, isn't he? He did have a reputation for not being easy to get on with, but I got on very well with him. Lewis Gilbert said that they actually got him on for a specific reason, because they wanted someone with a storytelling skill. And at this point, Roald Dahl was well known for his short stories. So yeah, they got him on board and wanted him to bring his dark humour with it as well. So yeah, as you say, Dahl and Gilbert, they enjoyed each other's company, they enjoyed working together. And Roald Dahl was told that he had to deliver his first draft in just 8 weeks, and then a second one four weeks later, and then a complete script in 20 weeks. And he spoke about the script conferences, and he said Harry would usually nod off to sleep in the middle. But yeah, he delivered his first treatment in May 66, and obviously heavily inspired by the astronauts walking in space. So it went into the script. Oh yeah, so in January 1966, a US Air Force bomber went missing off the coast of Spain. And it had two bombs on board. It led to speculation that was something wasn't quite right, and there was one of the countries had been unfriendly to the other. So Broccoli said both stories gave our script a strong flavour of authenticity. So that, along with the space race, really heavily give them these ideas for this. Roald Dahl was told that they'd found a large volcano in Japan, and that should play a major part in the story. Now, Roald Dahl has said that he's never read any of Harold Bloom's treatment or drafts, but obviously he said they had probably and Hant told me commissioned a screenplay from him, and it hadn't been any good, but had picked out that idea and possibly one or two others which they had asked me to put in. So it's a case of, it's not that he's read it and stole those ideas. The producers have just relayed the ideas back to Roald Dahl.
Yeah.
And Dahl was also told by Cubby to begin the film with Bond faking his own death to then give his enemies, you know, false information. Sounds like at this point, Broccoli should just have written the script. Yeah, so, and we covered this when we talked about Harold Bloom as well, with his credit that he got, because he just got additional material by.
Mm.
And Bloom had said that Roald Dahl had changed none of the action that he'd himself written, and he should have been given a joint credit at the very least. And he said, had this picture been done here in Hollywood, I would have been properly credited. But the British weren't crazy about using American writers. I was very disappointed. And he went on to say that he made everything you saw on the screen. So, I mean, we'll never know, will we? Because we've got no way of seeing the before and the after.
I'm sure the scripts must be out there somewhere if any of the readers have got them, and we'd love to see them.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, the script was delivered by Roald Dahl. Broccoli and Saltzman were delighted with it. But Roald Dahl himself said, it's the biggest load of bullshit I've ever put my hand to. And but he was still reluctant to share the credit with Bloom, which, yeah, he said, I was told there'd be a share. I said, well, there's no way anyone's going to share the full credit. And that's what happened. So that's why you get the additional material by, because Roald Dahl stood by and, stood by his bullshit. So we've got a script in place somehow.
Yeah. Just want to say, we did a big lengthy segment on Roald Dahl back on the D episode, so well worth revisiting that. I know there's a lot more detail in there that you can enjoy on there. But yeah, I mean, something we talked about then was that this is the point in the Bond films where you get the element, the fantasy element starts coming in, and that's got to be a Roald Dahl element, hasn't it?
As people that have no doubt grown up reading his kids' books.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
And there's also the death of Aki, which is sort of that sudden death that happens in the middle, and that how that may or may not have been influenced by the death of Dahl's daughter, who died very suddenly. Those people have linked those two things together. But I think it's a terrific change to the formula at this point, and one that sticks, right?
Yeah.
So key crew. So cinematographer Ted Moore, who'd done the previous four movies, he was unavailable. He was off shooting a film called A Man for All Seasons, for which he was an Oscar-winning film eventually. So they hired Freddie Young to be the cinematographer. And Young was probably the most important and recognisable cinematographer in the UK film industry. He won two Oscars by this point for his work with David Lean on Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago. But interestingly, Lewis Gilbert said he was amused because he brought this guy on, Freddie Young, this acclaimed filmmaker, and Freddie Young was like, do you mind if my friend comes to the set to see the film being made? Because he's really interested. His friend turned up, it was David Lean. And David Lean, this acclaimed genius filmmaker, wanted to see how a Bond film was being made. So just Lewis Gilbert just was amazed. He found that just incredible. But Freddie Young is someone we'll cover on next week's episode, the XYZ. So yeah, come back for more on him. Returning as editor on the James on You Only Live Twice was Peter Hunt, but there was a bit of a roundabout journey for him coming on to edit this movie. Basically, after all the work he'd put into making Thunderball such success, Peter Hunt had made it clear that he wanted to direct the next Bond film himself, so You Only Live Twice. But when Cubby and Harry decided they wanted Lewis Gilbert to do it, Peter Hunt threw his toys out of the pram and resigned as the editor on the James Bond film. So he wasn't going to work on You Only Live Twice at all. They instead offered him a holiday. So Cubby, the diplomat, offered Peter Hunt, go on holiday, travel around the world and see how you feel after you've done that. Peter Hunt goes on this around the world trip. While he's in Japan, they're filming there. He goes down to set, patches things up with Cubby, and he then goes on to be second unit director on You Only Live Twice, and we'll talk about more about how he became editor later in the episode. Ken Adam is also back on his fourth Bond film as production designer, and he arguably delivers his most audacious sets ever on Bond. And again, we'll talk about that in more detail. Also on the You Only Live Twice, you've got William P. Cartledge. He's a familiar face on the Bond DVD extras and a regular collaborator with Lewis Gilbert. He was the assistant director. You've got Norman Wanstall, someone we talked about recently, as dubbing editor. Special effects by John Steers and stunts by Bob Simmons. And you've also got, this is the film where Vic Armstrong makes his Bond debut as well as a stunt performer. Titles by Maurice Binder, music by John Barry, more on those in a bit. But just to say, you mentioned this this volcano they found in Japan. Lewis Gilbert, Harold Jack Bloom, Freddie Young and Ken Adam went to Japan to scout for locations. And they basically charted the whole of Japan by helicopters flying through the air. And they were looking for a suitable castle to be Blofeld's lair in the movie. But they actually found the volcanoes instead at a place called Kyushu. And this sparked the idea of the volcano lair. Also on that trip, some of the things that they ended up doing that ended up in the movie was going to the bathhouse and also the ninjas. And the crew, this expedition, the small group of filmmakers who'd gone out there, they were due to fly home. But at the last minute, they were told that they could go and see a ninja demonstration. They really wanted to see it before they flew home. So they changed their flights, went to see the ninja demonstration. Later that day, they found out that the flight they were meant to be on crashed and had everyone on board had died in this plane crash. This is the BOAC Flight 911. And it was, in fact, the third fatal passenger airline accident in Tokyo that month. So wow. They were really lucky at that stage. But there you've got some new faces and some familiar ones as well. And to talk about Sean Connery's return, we are going to be joined by our guest, AJ Black. Welcome to the show, AJ Black, the author of Cinematic Connery.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We're talking You Only Live Twice, and in this part of the show, we usually have a look at the returning Bond actor, and as you've written the book on Connery, we thought you'd invite you on.
Certainly written a book.
You've written a book. So the book's The Cinematic Connery, and it sort of charts his all of his movie roles, is that right?
Yeah, it goes through from pre-Bond in the late 50s, all the way through to the questionable League of Extraordinary Gentlemen right at the very end of his career. And then, yeah, it gets into, it's not a biography as such, but it gets into the movies themselves, what they meant at the time, how they fitted into the wider culture. And it tracks his story through those, really. So, but the Bonds obviously have a very big component all the way through, really. Because Bond stays with him right from the beginning almost to the very end. So, yeah, it's a good
right up to Sir Billy.
Sir Billy, yeah.
it's a bit... That was a fun one. Fun in quote marks to research. Yeah.
So on You Only Live Twice, we've got Sean Connery returning for the fifth time to play Bond. But at what sort of stage of his career was he at in 1967 when he signed up for You Only Live Twice? What can you tell us?
Well, 67, he's kind of reached that pop culture height in the 60s, you know, because arguably he's, as everyone listening to this I'm sure will already know, he's arguably one of the iconic figures of the 1960s in terms of entertainment, popular culture. You know, his visage on those Bond posters is up there with some of the biggest iconography of that decade. So by 67, he is there, you know, did you see that film Last Night in Soho? Where
yes.
You see the billboard of Thunderball and he's just emblazoned. So he's reached that point and his career is around Bond. He's a star name now, but his career around Bond has mixed various roles that sort of lean into the Bond persona. You know, things like Hitchcock's Marnie, where he plays a bit of a devilish kind of character. Woman of Straw for Basil Dearden, where he's playing another suited devilish sort of role. So he's sort of doing a riff on Bond without directly doing Bond, but he seems to be caught up in that in that area. But by 67, he's kind of had enough, really. By Once You Only Live Twice comes around, which is the last film he's contracted to do as part of the deal with Eon, he's ready to move on now. He's ready to put Bond behind him. As much as Bond is what has made him probably the biggest star in the world by this point, if not one of them.
Am I right in thinking that on the way, or before production starts, that he actually announces that it's going to be his last film?
Yeah.
His last Bond film.
He says, this is it. I am done. You know, and he's quite, in press interviews, he's quite to the point about that. You know, very vocally, openly saying, I'm not doing any more after this. And, you know, there are attempts to get him to do more after this, but he's wanting to draw a line in the sand. He wants to move on. He wants to do other things with his career. And he's got a level of bitterness at this point about Bond, mainly based on a lot of the contract negotiations, a lot of the things he feels like he's been done out of in terms of financially, more than anything else. You know, I think there is a strained relationship with Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman at this point, which is meaning that he's finding it hard to really engage with this creation that's made his name. So, yeah, he's very clear, I'm done. I'm done after Yolt.
Because he wanted to be more involved, didn't he, with the producing side?
Yeah, yeah. He wanted to be what I suppose Daniel Craig kind of became, really, you know, during his tenure, where he's got that sort of... I think Daniel Craig had a co-producer credit, I think, didn't he, on some of the later films.
Spectre and No Time to Die, yeah.
Right, yeah. So he's much more involved in the process. He's much more connected to the directors and the script, whereas Connery... was still that era where you're almost a gun for hire, I guess. And I think later on, Roger Moore didn't have as big a problem with that in many ways. You know, he turned up and did what he had to do, and that was it. But Connery always had the aspiration of being an actor's actor. You know, he always wanted to be that guy. And I think it stemmed from the fact that I talk about this in the book, that he really did skirt that British new wave of actors coming out of the 50s. You know, people like Richard Harris, you know, Richard Burton, Albert Finney, all of these actors who in the late 50s were really making their name on the theatre. They were making their name in popular, you know, far grittier movies than Connery. In fact, funnily enough, I was watching This Sport in Life recently with Richard Harris. Great early 60s movie. And I think Connery maybe auditioned for that at the time, or he was discussed, and he would have been great as this big, burly rugby player, hard-drinking guy. You know, an alternative sort of path for him if he'd gone more down that road. And he very much, like I say, skirted the edges of that. You know, he's becoming friends with people like Michael Caine, who was on the edge of that. So he's got those aspirations to be taken seriously. And I think on the one hand, while Bond makes him arguably a bigger star than any of those guys ever were, it's tainted a little bit for him and he wants more.
He almost sees it as being beneath him to a certain extent. And I think, obviously, with the films on the trajectory that they were on at this stage, they are getting more outlandish. The gadgets are getting more fantastical. And you can see, well, I think that's obviously comes across a little bit in the film. And something we looked at as well was the fact that it seems to me that Eon delayed start of production on You Only Live Twice, perhaps as a way of keeping Connery happy.
Well, yeah, I think generally they wanted him to carry on, even though he was quite vocal about this and he was quite vocally frustrated by it all. You know, once they got to the end of You Only Live Twice, they were looking at on a Majesty's Secret Service, and there was a conflict between wanting him to carry on because they knew how big he was, but at the same time, a frustration of, well, he keeps bad-mouthing this. You know, he keeps getting annoyed at the press intrusion, the fan intrusion, which was a big, powerful part of it, particularly during You Only Live Twice. You know, there's a famous story about how he's in the toilet and he gets mobbed by a bunch of fans, and he's outraged that they've crossed this line, you know, and actually found him in a toilet. And that's, you know, he really does reach a point there where, but they do go out of their way to try and appease him at this point, because they know that he is very much inextricably tied up with this character, you know, and people will shout James Bond at him in the street, not Sean Connery, you know, so he's defined by it. And that's part of the problem for him. So even though they want to bend over backwards to keep him happy at this point, it just pushes him further away in a way, you know, all of the other things around it.
In Any other returning cast to talk about, Brendan?
Yeah, we've got Q back, played by Desmond Llewellyn again, and he actually got to do some field Q. He flew to Japan.
Ah, welcome to Japan, Dad. Is my little girl hot and ready?
Look, 007, I've had a long and tiring journey, probably to no purpose, and I'm in no mood for your juvenile quips.
Also, Bernard Lee is back as M, and Lewis Gilbert, you know, said about his struggle with alcohol. Bernard Lee struggled with alcohol, and he said you had to shoot him in the morning because you couldn't get him in the afternoon. And William Cartledge said Bernard went off to the pub and crashed the car after lunch. We picked him up and brought him back to Pinewood. Bernard was a problem. So we've talked about Bernard Lee in the M episode and that ongoing struggle he had with alcohol. But as you can see, this early on, you know, it's creating an issue. And Lois Maxwell completes the MI6 team as Moneypenny again. But also we've got Burt Kwok.
Hey,
he's returning. He's Spectre Agent number 3, and he was previously a Chinese agent called Mr. Ling in Goldfinger.
And he's also in the other Bond film this year as well, isn't he? Casino Royale.
Of course he is. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's the only actor to appear in both the Bond films, the 67 Bond films, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Did you read that story about Desmond Llewellyn and the shorts?
No.
He had a real issue with the shorts that he was had to wear in the scenes as Field Q. He felt that they were not befitting for a man of his age and stature. And so he got them to change them to military shorts, which he felt were more acceptable. That's why he's got the khaki uniform on in those scenes. But
what were they before?
I don't know.
Hot pants.
Hot pants, yeah. God, don't. Right, new cast. So Bond girls. So Roald Dahl famously described the Bond girl formula. Talking about You Only Live Twice, said you put in three girls, no more, no less. Girl number one is pro-Bond. She stays around roughly through the first reel of the picture, and then she's bumped off by the enemy. That's Aki. Girl number two is anti-Bond. She works for the enemy and stays around throughout the middle third of the picture. She must capture Bond, and Bond must save himself by bowling her over with sheer magnetism. This girl should also be bumped off, preferably in original fashioned. That's Helga Brand. And then girl number three is violently pro-Bond. She occupies the final third of the picture and must on no account be killed, nor must she permit Bond take any lecherous liberties with her until the very end of the story. We keep that for the fade out. And then the other Bond girl, you've got Sai Chin, who is the girl in the pre-title sequence who Bond is in bed with. And this is the first of her two appearances in the Bond film. She later returned 39 years later in Casino Royale. Yeah, that's they're the Bond girls. We've talked about all of them so far in previous episodes, so I won't rehash too much here. But Akiko Wakabayashi is Aki, and she was a character that had been created for the film. And she was a Japanese actress, and she'd also been in a James Bond parody in Japan before she was in You Only Live Twice, and she had been in the Woody Allen film What's Up Tiger Lily as well. The filmmakers to shoot in Japan, they had been told that they had to use a certain amount of Japanese actors. And so that's why you've got two real Japanese stars, Akiko Wakabayashi and Mia Hamer in the two leads. And these two were chosen because they were expected that they would be able to learn English very quickly. And so they were flown over to England to learn English, and they were put in with English families, sent to school in the daytime. But Mia Hamer, unfortunately, didn't get very well with learning English. So they swapped their characters around, and Aki, so the character that Aki was playing, her name was changed from Suki to Aki. And interestingly, for Wakabayashi, her post You Only Live Twice credits is just one film and one TV series. She got an injury and then left the film business for a quieter life. And that actually is reflected in Mia Hamer as well. Again, she had been recommended for the film because she was good with English, and she also flew out with Akiko. And she, and while she was there, she was told that her English wasn't too good enough, and they were going to have to axe her from the film. But after having taken her out and told her this, Lewis Gilbert was informed that she was basically going to kill herself because of the shame of losing the role in the Bond film. So they basically said, we'll swap the roles. You can have the other role. And she obviously then stayed on the picture. And she was actually dubbed in anyway by Nikki van der Zyl. So we'll talk about her next week as well. Talking about You Only Live Twice much later on, she said, I'd never seen a 007 movie. I had no idea 007 was such a huge international hit. It was an honour to be a Bond girl, but once was enough. I didn't want that image to stick with me. And it was also one of her last film roles. And she walked out of her contract with a Japanese studio to raise a family. So, she also lives a very quiet life now, away from the public eye. And then Helga Brandt, which played by Karen Dorr, who was a German actor, and I believe we sort of talked about her in the past as well. But she was sort of a Fiona Volpe type character, and I think she's quite interesting. She's got the red hair, again, makes her sort of similar to Fiona Volpe. But yeah, three interesting Bond girls, and specifically Aki. I think she's a real sort of change in the norm from what we've had in the past. You know, she's a very capable secret agent herself. Very much the match for Bond, and a sort of a change for what we expect from Bond girls going forward.
Yep. So then we've got the villains, and we've got Jan Verrick as Ernst Stavro Blofeld.
Do we?
Well, sort of. We talked about this before. Harry Saltzman wanted comedic actor from Czechoslovakia Jan Verrick to take the part of Ernst Stavro Blofeld, and he accepted. And obviously he turns up and he meets Lewis Gilbert, and Lewis Gilbert sees this kind, grandfatherly, Santa Claus like character come through the door who can barely speak English, and this really sort of raised some doubts in Lewis Gilbert's mind, as you would imagine. But he gave him the benefit of the doubt and decided to go ahead and shoot with him. But it took only 5 days before he was fired. He realised he just wasn't right for the part at all. And they replaced him with Donald Pleasance, and that's who we get in the film. But you can still see Jan Verrick. You can see the top of his hair in some of the scenes at the end of the film, especially when Bond meets Blofeld for the first time. You can definitely see that he's there. He sees white hair at the top. But Donald Pleasance, he had the same agent as Connery, so he was able to sort of take over at short notice. And he says, I ended up spending 3 very, very intensive weeks playing that role to the bolts on the camera instead of another actor. Understandably, it really wasn't an enormously rewarding or fulfilling experience. He said that the producers liked his style, but they didn't find him physically imposing, which is what they wanted from the character of Blofeld. So they decided to go with his suggestion of giving Blofeld a physical defect. So they gave him a facial scar. And William Cartledge said that in those days, you actually used glue. When it dried, it pinched your skin and made it look like an ugly scar. That's quite painful. He ended up with really severe bruising down his face.
I mean, it looks painful to look at.
It really does, yeah. So, yeah. Obviously, Donald Pleasant's version of Blofeld goes on to inspire mainly the most memorable is Dr. Evil from Austin Powers series. Yeah. But he's also just the blueprint of many, many villains moving forward, really. So absolutely iconic, and especially with his white Persian cat as well, who is sadly traumatized in the end when the explosions are going off. Just it gets worse every time I see it. That cat is just really wants to escape, and it did escape, and it went missing for a couple of days actually, and they found it hiding some of the rafters and at Pinewood on a set.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Then we have another villain. We've got Mr. Rosato, who He's a member of Spectre, played by Teru Shimada. And the actor, he appeared in different shows. The Doris Day Show, $6 Million Man, Hawaii Five-O. You see he's sort of done the rounds of that era of American TV. But in Hawaii Five-O, he played Mr. Shigato, who was a Japanese businessman. That's probably his most famous role outside of this. And then we've got Peter... how do you pronounce his name? Peter Fanani Maver?
Mavia, yeah.
Mavia. As car driver. And he's one of...
Why have you brought this guy up, Brendan?
Oh, I wonder.
Well, I mean, to be fair, this fight scene is iconic.
The fight scene is fantastic.
Other, it is really good, where they're whacking each other with a sofa and they're and Bond's got those awesome shoes on, and I love that scene. I love it.
Heavily choreographed. They worked a long time on that scene to get it right, and it does pay off massively.
Go on, say the line.
What line?
Who is he?
Peter Fanani Maver. There we go. Move on.
Who is he, though? Come on.
He's related to someone.
Just say it. Everyone's here to hear it.
His grandson.
He is the grandfather of...
The Rock.
The Rock. Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Yeah. There you go. There's your trivia. Look at the allies then. So a couple of really good ones here. You've got Tetsuro Tamba as Tiger Tanaka. Tanaka is the head of the Japanese Secret Service in You Only Live Twice.
Fantastic.
We covered him at great length on our tea episode. It was the Tiger Tanaka, Tetsuro Tamba. It was the most tea person we could find. He was voiced in the movie by Robert Rietti, and it was Tamba who helped find a lot of the Japanese cast locally. He was the one that sort of helped find Akiko Wakabayashi and Mia Hamer. And Tamba got the role after Toshiro Mifune turned it down, the legendary Japanese actor. But please revisit our tea episode to hear some of what happened to Tetsuro Tamba after Bond and the weird sex cult that he set up.
Oh, fantastic.
And then we've got Charles Gray as Dicko Henderson. Now, this is Charles Gray's first James Bond movie appearance, and he plays Bond's contact in Japan. He's a character in the Fleming novel, actually, and he has a false leg, and he offers Bond a martini that is stirred and not shaken before he's killed. And of course, Charles Grey returns just a few films later as Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever. And again, I believe, is it The Spy Who Loved Me is the voice in Cairo? Anyway.
Yes, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. So I mean, that's the cast. I mean, it's a decent lineup. But let's dive into production.
So we have the pre-title scene, and the filming began at Pinewood, actually, July 1966, and they filmed that first scene where Connery is in bed with Sai Chin, and that's where he gets peppered with bullets, and then the opening sequences in Hong Kong. They use location footage of a street in Kowloon. We see the Victoria Harbour in Hong Kong as well, and the sea burial of Bond, and then the retrieval of his corpse is filmed off Gibraltar and the Bahamas. And that was the scenes with the aircraft taking Bond after his death were shot over Buckinghamshire, when it was supposed to be Japan. So Buckinghamshire, I mean, it does not look like Japan, but that's where we see, that's the pre-title sequence there. And then it's off to Japan for a lot of it, isn't it?
Yes. So the production, filmed in Japan from July 1966, while the World Cup was actually taking place in England. There's actually some really great photos of the England World Cup team visiting Pinewood, and you've got Connery with Bobby Moore and all that sort of stuff. Those photos are well worth seeking out. But anyway, while the World Cup was going on, they were in Japan. They were actually following it quite closely while in Japan, and Cubby would lay on football matches and all sorts of stuff to keep everyone happy over there. But some of the locations that they filmed in Japan, one of them was the Kuramai Kokugi-kan, the national sports dome, which is where they have the sumo fight. And I didn't know this before, but a real life sumo champion, like a huge celebrity at the time, this guy called Sado Yanama, he actually cameos playing himself in the fight. And they packed the dome out with 12,000 real extras by giving away free tickets to see this legendary sumo star. And this was the scene that Freddie Young invited David Lean along to watch being filmed. Like I said, you've got some field cue action there filmed in Japan. And the fight with the gyrocopter and the helicopters were filmed over the mountains of Kyushu. But the lip of the volcano where you see Bond and Kissy Suzuki looking into, that was filmed at the lip of a dormant volcano on Mount Shinmo. They actually had to fly up there in helicopters, or at least they flew the most important crew members up there in helicopters, but the rest of the crew had to go up on horseback. And there was one day I read about where a huge fog descended on the mountain, and they all had to walk back down because the helicopters couldn't come up and pick them. And Lewis Gilbert remembers Sean Connery and Cubby Broccoli, you know, helping to carry all the equipment down the mountain. So quite an interesting vision that. Other locations in Japan included the Kobe docks, the Kagoshima seaport, a place called Himeji Castle, which was the ninja training school. And that castle is also used in some Akira Kurosawa films as well, Kagemusha and Ran. And then you've got the Hotel New Otani, which is still there in Japan. And that was the exterior of Asato Chemicals. And just a few things to say about Japan. I don't know if you remember our Barbara Broccoli episode, but there was that story of her being on set when they were filming the tea ceremony. And that was one of her first memories of being on a Bond set. And then you've also got the fishing village in Akimi, which is on the southern coast of Kyushu, where the volcanoes were. And they filmed there, but they were sort of troubled by paparazzi there. And then something to note about those scenes there is that Connery's wife, Diane Shalento, was there on set, and she actually doubled for some of the Japanese women swimming in the sea because she was a much stronger swimmer than they were. And she just popped on a black wig and some ill-fitting swimming costumes and jumped in and did it for herself. And then the scene where Helga Brandt's plane crashes somewhere in Japan, they actually filmed that in Scotland. So, yeah, Scotland doubling for Japan there. But Japan in this movie is one of those rare occasions where you really feel the location. You know, feels like a travelogue movie. You feel like you're there. You can feel the sweat. You can feel the humidity there. I think it's such a great location for this movie.
Definitely. Yeah.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But let's return to our conversation with AJ Black about to hear more about Connery's time in Japan, because he didn't have an easy time.
Yeah, so while I was looking at this, the making of this film, just the initial reaction when he got to Japan, some of the stories that come out are alarming, aren't they? How he was treated.
Yeah, there were a lot of things in there that were, you know, that were frustrating for him during the making of it.
There's really good stuff on the making of documentary where you can see when they're in the fishing boats scenes later on, you can see there's boats being chartered of press just to sort of come in and film them. And as we know from sort of experience, that shooting on water's hard enough in itself, not let alone with having boats and stuff floating around behind you.
Yeah.
And other stuff, I can't imagine it would have been that sort of nice to film in those temperatures either. I seem to recall them talking about how uncomfortable it was shooting there as well.
Yeah, it was the humidity was unbearable at times, wasn't it? But they, you know, they tried to sort this out by getting guards. He had 12 guards, didn't he?
Right.
Which worked for a short time, because one morning then they turned up and all the guards had cameras. So so that an end had to be put to that. So everything they were trying to sort of diffuse the situation, it just wasn't working.
Yeah, and it just riled him up terribly. You know, that the constant press intrusion. I think he described it afterwards. He suggested that the timeline doesn't exactly match up, I suppose, but he compared it to Beatlemania. You know, but I think he said something along the lines of, with the Beatles, there were at least four of them. You know, I was just on my own, you know, where he was dealing with that amount of intrusion. So, yeah, it just got too much for him.
Well, I think the timelines do match up, actually. And in fact, the fact that you mentioned the Beatles, I don't know if you've read AJ Chowdhury's and Matthew Field's book, Some Kind of Hero, but they make a really good analogy that in 1966, the Beatles stopped playing live because at Shea Stadium, it got so big, so loud, they just couldn't be heard playing. And they say, you know, Sean Connery gets to Pinewood in the biggest set that's ever been built in Europe, and they just can't hear him anymore. You can't see the acting anymore. He just feels completely done. And so that's why he decides to throw in the towel. I think it's a really good comparison. But yeah, I mean, I guess sort of combined with the not enjoying the work and then also the intrusion as well, you can kind of see why he'd want to get out of it at this stage.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, he wanted to look ahead and he wanted to stretch his wings. I mean, the year after he does a Western, he does Shalico, you know, which is a very different kind of heroic role, but it doesn't do massively well. And it's a strange sort of co-production kind of film. I think it was partly filmed in Spain. And he veers much more off into quite period territory. And he plays in some ways quite smaller, much more scaled down, if not grittier, but much more scaled back kind of roles, away from that exuberism. Because, you know, because as we say, with You Only Live Twice, like you said, it gets bigger. It is the biggest Bond film in terms of scale, you know. So particularly the Ken Adams amazing volcano set, you know, at the end, that had ever been. So he really did make a conscious effort at that point to scale it all back. You know, he had a real issue with being that superhero figure in popular culture at this stage that everyone wanted him to be, and all of the fans and all of the press, you know, Sean Connery is James Bond, you know, which was emblazoned on a lot of the posters. And he hated that kind of thing as well. You know, it was things like around the same time that his brother was going to Italy to do a tiny, strange film called OK Connery, that they actually named OK Connery, where he plays himself, Neil Connery, as a James Bond figure. You know, as a knockoff, and he hated all that stuff. You know, he really did. He didn't want to be involved in any of that, and it really frustrated him. It felt like people mugging off his name, almost. You know, making a profit out of him, trying to leech onto him. You know, and he didn't want any of it. You know, for somebody who was so famous, he was in some ways quite a conservative private man. He didn't really go out and do the hard drinking partying like some of those other new wave guys did. You know, he didn't really want that. So I think that's where it got too much for him.
So it's back to Pinewood, and we'll talk about now probably the sort of the absolute pinnacle of Bond production design, Blofeld's Volcano Lair. And this is the site for Spectre's launch site for Spectre's spacecraft. And it was built into an extinct Japanese volcano. Now, don't think too hard about the logistics of that. just enjoy the dream logic of that and how you would go about doing that and what that would cost. But the idea, like I said, they came from them flying over this volcano and thinking, oh, wouldn't it be cool to put a base in there? And so Ken Adam was then tasked with designing it. And it would end up being the biggest and most complex film interior ever built in Europe by that point. And it was big enough to fly a helicopter through it. When asked how much it would cost after looking at the initial sketches, Ken told Cubby Broccoli about £1 million. Cubby went, let's do it. So that 1 million figure, that obviously is more than the entire budget of Dr. No, which is something we've talked about in the past. So built on the Pinewood lot, it was actually built over the tank, which is where they end up in the future building the 007 stage over. So where the lair, where the volcano lair is where now where the 007 stage stands. But in comparison to the 007 stage, it actually, that volcano set occupied twice the footprint and height of the 007 stage.
Wow.
So it's the biggest Bond set ever, basically, I think. And so it had the heliport, it had a operating monorail. Basically, it was a 360-degree set in some places where you could just walk around and it felt like a real place. And you could actually see the set from the main road up to 3 miles away. And you need to see the photos of this because it is absolutely unbelievable. But they the top of it is open to the elements, basically. It looks incredible. And one of the facts I read was it required more tubular steel to build than was used to build the London Hilton Hotel. It was 200 feet across, 55 feet high on the side, rising on a slope up to 125 feet high, 70 feet in diameter, 700 tons of steelwork, and it took 50 plasterers and 60 riggers working day and night to build it. And talking about the set that he designed, Ken Adams said, "The nightmare comes from suddenly realising you have designed something that has never been done before in films, and that is bigger than any set ever used before. You wake up at night wondering whether or not the whole thing will work." And it was such a landmark build in the British film industry at the time that the cast and crew would bring their families to Pinewood at the weekends to see it being built. And the builders literally worked round the clock. And Ken Adam recalled he was at a party one night, but he ended up leaving at 2 a.m. to go down to set to see the set being built with his wife. And they took a bottle of brandy with them to the builders, climbed up to the top and enjoyed a drink with them. But the space itself was, you know, open to the elements. It was really difficult conditions to work on and absolutely freezing cold. And Lewis Gilbert recalls thinking, oh my God, we're going to have a blue leading lady. But when it was finished, they opened this set to press and they had a big press event. And the photos ended up in newspapers all around the world. And so filming began in there on the 31st October 1966. And cinematographer Freddie Young said that it was going to take every lamp we have, plus all the candles we can find to light it, which is quite a funny, funny vision. As discussed, you know, Bob Simmons was the stunt coordinator on this film and he coordinated the ninja assault on the base. He hired 120 stuntmen for it, with 40 of them sliding down ropes into the base. And all they used, their safety equipment, was a length of hose pipe on the rope to slow them down as they were rappelling down into the base. And I think one stuntman actually misjudged it and ended up breaking his feet or his ankles or something.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's crazy. And in this scene, famously, they introduced this idea of the use of trampolines to simulate explosions for the stuntmen. But I know you're a fan of this sequence, Brendan. I mean, it's an absolutely phenomenal achievement, I think, on camera.
You can't quite imagine it, can you? Being there. Mm. It's a lot to even... You look at it, go, there's no way they'd do this now. No. This is insane.
It is insane, yeah. Absolutely insane. I think probably for health and safety reasons they couldn't do it now.
Yeah.
Should we talk about another health and safety disaster?
Another memorable moment from this film is Little Nelly. And Little Nelly had been discovered by Ken Adam. And he was listening to the radio and had heard Ken Wallace, who was a wing commander, and he'd created a small one-man helicopter. And so he's talking about it on BBC Today programme. And the film had an aviation advisor called Hamish Mahady. And so he called Ken Wallace and he said, "Can you come and demonstrate this autogyro at Pinewood?" So Ken Adam, if you remember way back when, episode one, was a fighter pilot during World War II. So he was obviously impressed with this, especially after the demonstration as well. He'd seen it in action. So Ken Wallace said, "Cubby Broccoli stood looking at it and he said, 'We shall want it in Japan in 6 weeks' time.'" Typical Cubby, isn't it? Demanding. But Ken Wallace was actually meant to be scheduled to appear in a James Bond spoof being shot in Brazil when he got that call. So obviously you sack off the spoof, don't you? And you go for the real thing. And then obviously, you know, with that in mind, they know they want to use this Little Nelly. Roald Dahl has to find a place for it. So he did. He managed to slot it into his script. So Ken Wallace also met with John Steers so that they could talk about any weaponry and how it would look and how it could be adapted to be more of a Bond gadget, I guess. And he said there was a thought of having a corkscrew on top of the rotor blades that you screw into the enemy helicopter, but I didn't think that was a very good idea.
No,
no, one step too far, that one, I think. Ken Adam said it would be interesting. So it's Ken Adam's idea is why we've got this weird shot in the film where it builds itself, you know, the do-it-yourself. Mm. He said, so that being a part of its charm, He said, so I came up with the idea of the very chic crocodile suitcases. And they were designed by Ken's wife. So yeah, like you said, this was filmed in the mountains of Kyushu. And this was directed by Peter Hunt. And yeah, I mean, it's good that they gave him this, because this is, you know, he goes on to, well, his next film is On Her Majesty's Secret Service, isn't it? Which heavily relies on aerial shots.
Yeah, helicopters, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, to get this scene, the 7.5 minutes it is, little Nelly's on screen, Ken Wallace spent 46 hours in the air and took off 85 times, which is insane, really. So yeah, Peter Hunt said that this sequence was created because they proposed a car chase in the screenplay, but then they discovered this and they just obviously replaced it. So whilst filming the scenes, I think if you remember, if you go back to Jay, we talked about Johnny Jordan. They were shooting some scenes and there was an updraft, and Johnny Jordan, who was getting some of the shots, his foot was severed by the helicopter below. It went straight through his foot.
Oh, God.
Yeah, absolutely awful business. And so obviously he was whisked off to a hospital, and they did manage to reattach his foot. But later on, after he was ill for a long time and he was getting like really good healthcare, and Cubby obviously was looking after him and stuff. But it wasn't getting any better, and he was really in a bad way. Unfortunately, after he had to have it amputated in London. But once it was amputated, he was back. He made a really quick recovery, and he continued working with a prosthetic foot. So because of the shots that involved explosions, the Japanese government didn't allow them to get those shots. So they moved to Torremolinos in Spain, because it resembled most closely to the Japanese landscape. And then, yeah, if you want to know more about Johnny Jordan, if you go back to the Jay episode.
Yeah, we did it.
Because it does have a sad ending, unfortunately. But, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting scene. What do you think of the Little Nelly scene?
Well, you say that Roald Dahl slotted it in. I would say more like he shoehorned it in, because it's a little bit incongruous with the rest of the film. It does feel like they found the gadget and then and put it in. I would like to see a gyrocopter return to a Bond film.
Gyrocopter and a jetpack. They're the two.
Yeah. In 2021, Shuttleworth, which is a place near me, it's an airfield, which is the home of Little Nelly. I went to see a gyrocopter display there, and the new ones look amazing. They're absolutely like, they've come up leaps and bounds. And I actually met Major Ken Wallace's wife there. I bought a Little Nelly postcard from her, and they're trying to raise money to restore Little Nelly to flying conditions. So, yeah, if you were ever at Shuttleworth in Hertfordshire, then you can go and see Little Nelly.
Wow.
There. Yeah, so there you go.
Hello, Base One.
Listening.
Little Nelly got a hot reception. Four big shots made improper advances towards her, but she defended her honour with great success. Heading for home.
Let's go into post-production then, and I tease some editing drama. But like I said, with Peter Hunt temporarily out of the picture on You Only Live Twice, Eon hired Thelma Connell as editor. She was a regular collaborator of Lewis Gilbert's. But when Peter Hunt returned from Japan, he'd actually made up with Cubby and Harry. And due to the second unit work that he'd done there, they'd basically patched things up. And so when he came back to England, found Thelma Connell editing the movie, Peter basically wanted to get back involved with the editing. And there was reports that there was an early cut that Thelma had done of the movie, which is 133 minutes in length. But she was really struggling to get the film into shape. And so Peter Hunt came in, muscled her out of the picture. She left the movie and Peter Hunt took over editing. And his reward for getting You Only Live Twice back into shape, like he had done with Thunderball, he got to direct On Her Majesty's Secret Service. But the question a lot of people have asked is this deleted footage? This film was 15 minutes longer when Thelma Connell was cutting it. Where's all that footage? What happened to it? That's an intriguing what if of what was cut from the movie.
Oh, I thought you had an answer.
I don't have an answer, I'm afraid. But titles. What do you know about the titles, Brendan?
So titles, I mean, we've got Morris Binder back again, and he really leans in heavily to to get flavours of Japan in this one, and also a nod to the finale of the film. So we see lava and volcanoes. Obviously, he uses silhouettes, and the typeface is oriental as well. But Daniel Kleiman, he actually notes it as one of his favourites. So Daniel Kleiman obviously does them now. But he said, I think it's my favourite sequence because I love the Japanese imagery. I think it's so clever with the parasols making these amazing patterns, and the colours are really spectacular with the geishas and the volcanoes. I love that era of imagery, so it's nostalgic for me as well. It's such a great song, and Nancy Sinatra does it so well. It's a great sequence. I love it. What do you think on these titles?
I have to totally agree with Daniel Kleinman. I think it's some of my favourite of the pre-title of the title sequences. I know we talked about in Thunderball that really being the one that cemented the template for what we expect from Bond titles. But Morris Binder here is one instance where you can see he's taken what he knows and just moved it on leaps and bounds into something bold and new. And then you'll see it again with the Honor Majesty's. But this one really stands out for me. Music for the film. You've got John Barry returning for his fourth Bond score. He had sort of huge success with Thunderball. And in the interim between that film and this one, he'd written the music for The Chase, Born Free, The Wrong Box and The Quiller Memorandum, which was another spy film. So you can see now John Barry is really becoming an in-demand writer. And I think You Only Live Twice, the score is absolutely magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
It's built around three sort of main themes. You've got the title song, the Space March, and then a romantic theme as well. Unlike Thunderball, though, John Barry didn't visit Japan on this one for inspiration. He sort of relied on his own imagination. He was probably too busy, to be honest. But talking about it years later, he said there was a more melodic and more... This was more melodic and more subtle. I tried to intertwine the whole Japanese thing, the elegance, the oriental feel into the story. And so the music for You Only Live Twice was recorded over 6 days between April 10th and May the 2nd, 1967. And in comparison to, I don't know if you remember with Thunderball, but there was so much chaos and last minute changes and, you know, with the title song changing and the music being added in, this one was much smoother sailing. And actually the film was shorter as well, and he needed to make less music. So you've got 65 minutes of score here. And so Barry basically spent March and April writing the score, and then April and the 6 days there recording it. But he was so busy working on You Only Live Twice that he wasn't able to attend the Oscars, where he won two Oscars for Born Free. So, he had to enjoy that one from afar, sadly. But for me, I mean, Capsule in Space and then the fight at Kobe Docks, I think, are both real highlights. And also the version of the Barry's 007 theme for the Little Nelly sequence is chef's kiss. I just love the music in this. Absolutely. It's absolutely brilliant. One interesting thing to note, though, that annoyed John Barry is that Peter Hunt used the original 62 recording of the James Bond theme in the helicopter chase. And that annoyed John Barry because he would have preferred the opportunity to rework it. He said there was just no intrigue and no dramatically. And he wished he had been given the opportunity to create something more interesting with the Bond theme.
Ah, so the title song, yeah. So it's a ballad written by Leslie Bricusse, this one. And he said that he had a good time writing this one. He said he'd been invited down to Palm Springs for the weekend by Kirk and Anne Douglas. And he took the music of You Only Live Twice with him. And he had an autumn Sunday morning. He sat and he wrote in Kirk's study. And he said he remembers smugly thinking as he sat there, how good can it get? I was the house guest of Spartacus, writing for James Bond. So the track was written in towards the end of 1966. And it was recorded by Julie Rogers. But they both thought, both John Barry and Leslie Bricusse thought that they could get it better. And so they met in Hollywood in 1967, at the start of 1967, and they started again. Unfortunately, there was a slight bit of, you said there was no tension on this, but in terms of the song, there was. Harry Saltzman had hired a musical supervisor to oversee the score, and this had ramifications on the song, because then there was a dispute over who was going to record the song. So there's many different accounts of whether it was John Barry or the musical supervisor who rejected Aretha Franklin, but someone did. She was an up-and-coming star at that time. But Lewis Gilbert said, when the movie was all over, Cubby told me that he was going to America to talk to Frank Sinatra. He was a great buddy of Frank Sinatra's. And the next thing I know, Nancy was doing it. So, Frank apparently turned it down and passed it along down the line, and it got to Nancy. And she said, I was 26 and really scared. I'd rather have a root canal than go through that again. So maybe they should have tried to persuade Frank a bit more. So because of the style of the song, Nancy Sinatra said that she didn't normally sing songs like that. And by the end of the session that they had at the recording studios, there was no version of Nancy Sinatra's rendition that was usable. And so John Barry said, what's now in the movie is made up of about 24 takes. It's a real masterpiece of editing. There was just no way we'd ever have got it in one take.
Sounds like our podcast.
Yeah, so but it did get it got finished. I think it complements the titles wonderfully. And there was also, so it reached number 44 in the US and number 11 in the UK. So in terms of the Julie Rogers one, it's out there. You can listen to it. And it's appeared on some James Bond CDs as well, compilations. In the 90s, there was an alternative example of the theme song, sung by Lorraine Chandler, which was discovered at the vaults of RCA Records.
Oh, interesting.
And it became a really popular track with the Northern Soul scene. So Chandler herself was known for her high-quality soul output. Again, you know, you can find it. It's out there. It's quite good, actually. I had a listen to it. Maybe we'll drop a clip in here. But it pops up on a lot of soul compilations as well.
So a couple of promotional bits to mention before we talk about the release of the film. But first of all, the posters. I have to mention the posters. We talked about on Thunderball because this is really the peak age of James Bond posters, in my opinion. You've got Robert McGuinness and Frank McCarthy returning to do the poster artwork. Robert McGuinness did the one where you've got Bond in the bathhouse with all the women around him. And also you've got the poster with little Nelly flying through the air. And then Frank McCarthy, his is the amazing one of Connery walking around the rim of the crater in the tuxedo. But it's got some really nice typeface work on it. You've got the double use of twice, the twice that splits in two. You've got Connery holding the space helmet underneath his arm. That's the first time you sort of see a variation on the Bond silhouette with the space helmet under his arm. And then you've also got the typeface screaming, "Sean Connery is Bond," in response, obviously, to Casino Royale as well. But just an amazing series of posters there. The original artwork, Robert McGuinness's original artwork for You Only Live Twice, the bathhouse one, came up for auction in 2019, and it sold for $65,000 to a private bidder after an estimate of 20 to 30,000. So a very popular piece of artwork, that one. But something else to mention, a bit of promo work, Brendan, which I really enjoy for this movie. It's a TV special.
Yeah, so United Artists Television, they produced a 1-hour special called "Welcome to Japan, Mr. Bond," and it was shown in June 1967 in the US on the NBC channel, and it featured Desmond Llewellyn and Lois Maxwell reprising their roles of Q and Miss Moneypenny. Miss Moneypenny's got an assistant in this.
Yeah, Kate Mara?
It's Kate O'Mara, yes.
Yeah,
and so the premise of this is it's to show clips from the previous four Bond films, and with little teasers from You Only Live Twice, and interspersed, you've got interactions between those three characters. It's worth a look. It's on YouTube. It's available. It's out there.
It's really worth watching, even just for the bits of Lois Maxwell with Kate O'Mara and Lois Maxwell with Desmond Llewellyn. It's like seeing a missing Bond scene that you've never seen before. I love it. I think it's so much fun.
Moneypenny, what a delightful surprise. Oh, you don't often come and visit me.
Oh, thank you, Q. You obviously know much more about this than I do. Do you know who the girl is?
Haven't a clue, Moneypenny, haven't a clue.
Well, can you tell me anything?
Well, I can only tell you that I've spent weeks working on this Aston Martin, trying to get it back into working order. I can't imagine what 007 does to leave a car in this condition.
But yeah, it's a clip movie. It's interesting to see a clip movie or a clip show made up just of the first four Bond films.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nowadays you have so many films to include, but actually you can actually look, sort of almost luxuriate in all these clips from the golden age of Bond, can't you?
Yeah.
It's lovely. I really like it. So You Only Live Twice premiered at the Odeon Leicester Square in London on the 12th of June 1967. Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip were in attendance. It was their very first Bond premiere. And also in attendance, after missing the Thunderball premiere, was Sean Connery. And he was there with Diane Cilento, making his last, at that time, public appearance as Bond. Although he had a moustache and he had no wig on. So he looks very different to how he does in the movie. And actually, in this movie, I'd say his toupee is probably one of the worst. It doesn't look very convincing to me in this movie.
I agree. I also think it doesn't help throughout the... I know it's problematic, but just to mention that when he does change his race, let's say, the wig, because of his wig, it's really obvious it's a wig.
Yeah.
And so you just think, well, is the rest of it a wig? Is it all a wig?
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Also at the premiere was Jerry Lewis, Phil Silvers and Dick Van Dyke, as well as Roald Dahl and Cubby and Harry. Guy Hamilton was also there at the premiere. And then the film opened across the UK and United States the following day. It set an opening day record at the Odeon Leicester Square and went on to be number one in the United States with a weekend gross of $600,000. So slightly down on Thunderball, it took a global box office haul of $111 million. That's down on Thunderball's $142 million. Probably impacted by Casino Royale, let's be honest, which is only out a few months earlier. That took about $41 million. So you've got to wonder whether or not people were suffering a bit of Bond fatigue by that point. Review-wise, got decent notices. Variety said that Sean Connery plays 007 with his usual finesse. Time magazine said that the outer space sequences would be more appropriate in a grade school educational short. And the volcanic climax is a series of clumsy process shots that no one took the trouble to fix. Even Connery seems uncomfortable and fatigued, as if he meant it when he said it, this would be his very last Bond film. It may just be an off year for 007. New York Times said, although there's a lot more science fiction than there is first vintage James Bond in You Only Live Twice, the fifth in a series of veritable Bond films with Sean Connery, there's enough of the bright and bland bravado of the popular British super sleuth mixed into this melee of rocket launching to make it a bag of good Bond fun. Roger Ebert said a great deal of money was spent on the fifth Bond epic in an attempt to duplicate this mystique, but in You Only Live Twice, the formula fails to work its magic. It says, Connery labours mightily. There is still the same Bond grin, still the cool humour under fire, still the slight element of satire. And when he puts on the cute little helmet and is strapped into his helicopter, somehow the whole illusion falls apart. But the film actually has a 74% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes from 54 reviews. So overall, generally, people are positive about the film. What about our followers on Twitter, Brendan?
So we've got quite a lot of response from this. So it varies, doesn't it, from film to film? But over 60 responses on this one.
Yeah, so we asked for your three-word reviews on Twitter and you send them in your droves, and that is a lot.
It is, yeah. So there's a lot of mention of Connery's performance. So Mrs. Steve O'Brien said Connery looks bored, and Ryan Zia-Doge says Connery is bored. So, yeah, that's Liam HRL Connery getting tired. Martin Barrett says fantastic rooftop fight, and I do think we should mention that because I love that shot.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, likewise.
Vinnie Harris 94 says high adventure escapism. Sydney Compass says massively underrated masterpiece.
Agree.
E.M. Ling says Niven was better.
Oh, harsh.
Harsh and also, I have to not disagree. True. Yeah. Damn Fool Idealistic Crusader says desperately needed Maybaum. What do you think about that?
Interesting.
I think it'd be a very different film without Roald Dahl.
Yeah, I think so. No, I'm sticking with Dahl on this one.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of people saying, I love you.
Which, yeah, I mean, that's the code, isn't it?
It's not really a review, but it's noted. Yeah, there's numerous mentions of the rooftop chase and also Connery looking tired or bored. Ian Tempest says, greatest theme ever. I don't know if that must be the song. I mean, I wouldn't say it's the greatest for me.
No,
but it certainly works with the film that it's in.
Yeah.
John Porter says bonkers, great fun.
Okay.
And Eric Newsom says Ken Adam transcends.
Very nice.
Yeah. So I think there's no real sort of hate for it.
No.
And I think anyone with negativity, it's about Connery looking a bit bored or tired. Which rather than hate, that seems like it's a bit sort of a missed opportunity,
it's
a constructive, I guess.
Constructive criticism, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's bring back AJ Black to have a quick chat about the film, but we'll return at the end just to wrap things up. So on this part of the show, we like to look at the sort of the history, the legacy of You Only Live Twice. AJ's back to join us for this section. So we've talked about it at length. Obviously, it was his final, at this time, his final James Bond film. But how did it sort of, how did leaving Bond at this stage affect Connery's career going forward?
He kind of ended up in a bit of a funny place, because he was offered a lot of money to do on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and he turned it down. And I think most Bond fans imagine that's one of, I mean, as really good as that film ends up being, it is kind of one of those lost great Bond possibilities, you know, especially if he'd then gone on to do Diamonds Are Forever, and how it starts off then where he's avenging Tracy almost, but it doesn't connect up at all, and it's really weirdly done. You know, I think it would have been a potentially fascinating alternate kind of Bond moment had he done that. But he turns that down. He turns down the lucrative offer to carry on and do it at least once more at that point. And like I say, he goes off and he does things like Sherlock Holmes. He does things like The Red Tent, which is a really unusual, co-Russian made movie where he plays almost second fiddle to Peter Finch. And it's a dramatization of a crash in the 1920s. He plays Roald Amundsen, the North Pole explorer who disappears. It's a really strange film, and he's only in it for a small part. These are stuff like the Molly Maguires from Martin Ritt, which is an interesting film alongside Richard Harris, set in a coal mining town in Pennsylvania in the 1860s. But they are dramas. They are much, much lower scale. They're not big. I know it was pre the term blockbuster as such, but they're not big movies that are going to drag everyone out to the front, you know, to the cinema. So his star is on the wane, really, at this point. After he gives this up, he struggles really to click with that. He can't quite move into that next phase of his career that he wants, because everyone still wants him to be Bond. And that's the tension that he finds. As much as he's working with interesting directors and he's playing interesting parts, he can't escape. And that leads to the next part of the Bond story for him, really, because he kind of has to go back in some ways in order to get onto the next step.
In terms of Connery's Bond films, where do you think You Only Live Twice sort of lands for you in terms of his performance?
I think it's a difficult one, because the cliche is to say he's bored throughout the whole thing. I don't know if I entirely agree with that at all points, really. I think there are points where he is phoning it in to an extent, but I think there are aspects of You Only Live Twice I think he's enjoying doing. And I think it's too easy to just say that it's his worst Bond performance. I wouldn't go that far, but I do think at this point he is, in a weird way, I think he maybe had more fun on Diamonds Are Forever in some senses, because that is much quirkier film in a way. And I think he had the impetus of that in order to go off and, you know, the deal he makes with United Artists, with David Picker, to make then two films he wants to do, including The Offence in the end with Sidney Lumet. So he's got that spring in his step in a way to make Diamonds, to get it out the way so he can do those other things. Whereas with You Only Live Twice, it's the end of a road, really. So I think he's okay in it, but I think he's almost at his peak in terms of that power in Thunderball, oddly enough. I think Goldfinger's the most fun one he's doing, but I think he looks amazing in Thunderball, and he's got that pure confidence and ease. And I think by You Only Live Twice, it's maybe fading slightly, I think, there, really. So it's a strange one. It's a strange one. I think after Thunderball and Goldfinger, I think his next best one is Never Say Never Again years later, in terms of how he looks and how much fun he's having. But that's just me. I'm a big fan of that one.
Big fan of dungarees.
I am. Love dungarees. Absolutely. Yeah.
Brendan, do you see Connery being bored in this one?
I don't really. I don't really get that from him. I get an agent, like if you look at him as the character, I'd get an agent who he's been there, he's done that. It's another mission. He's getting on with it, rather than bored. And I, you know, I really enjoy this film, and there's a lot of fun to be had. With Diamonds Are Forever, that is an absolute slog. However, off camera, he was having way more fun, wasn't he? You know, so he's just gambling, he's playing golf, he's having a lot of fun with that, and gets 1.25 million as well. So I'm sure that softens the blow. But yeah, Live Twice, the off camera stuff, it's difficult to not let it seep in, isn't it? I think.
Mm, yeah. He maybe feels a little bit heavy on him you know, the weight of that is maybe sitting a little bit heavy on him. And I think that maybe is where that comes across as boredom in a way. Mm. But I don't think he ever really truly shows that in any Bond film, even though they vary in quality, some of them. I don't think he's ever shown boredom. I think he's always trying to give that performance. But by you only have twice, he just knows it inside out. It's like doing a play on the 100th night after you've done it all those nights before for him. I think he's not so much bored as feeling like it's done. I want to move on. So and he's got that heaviness on him. I think that's the slight difference with You Only Live Twice, certainly compared to the previous ones in the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the legacy and its place in the canon, I think You Only Live Twice is really interesting because, it's like you say, it's the end of the road for that trajectory. And then what they follow it up with is something, you know, a complete left turn, really, in terms of the scale and the gadgets and stuff that they sort of turn away from. And then just one film after, you've got Diamonds Are Forever. I mean, you put those three films together, You Only Live Twice, Unimagined Secret Service, and Diamonds Are Forever, and you could not find a more disparate trio of Bond films when they could have been the greatest, you know, the greatest Blofeld trilogy of the whole Bond canon, really. It's kind of crazy, really.
Yeah, it's also a shame that he didn't get to make the 70s Bond movie that he was planning for years. I'm sure you guys know all about that story, you know, the Warhead 2000 story that he wanted to do with sharks under New York with lasers. It's kind of mad stuff that you feel like Mike Myers steals some aspect of later. But, you know, he had plans to make Bond beyond Diamonds Are Forever and it being much more involved. And that would have been a lot of fun to see. But, yeah, he's... I think that the great thing about Connery's Bond films, I think, is that they're all kind of different from each other in a way. Even though they have a lot of the Bond templates, you know, particularly Goldfinger onwards, they're all definably their own thing, really. And that's the joy, I suppose, of going back to them now. And, you know, I mean, everyone says Diamonds Are Forever is one of the worst Bond films, and it kind of is, but... It is, but I can't help but enjoy it every time for loads of reasons, like particularly John Barry's score as well, which is amazing. But like, yeah, he's like you said, Brendan, he's probably having more fun offset than we are watching it.
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us, Tony. It's been a real pleasure to have you joining us to talk about Connery.
Thanks a lot.
And the book Cinematic Connery is out now. It's got some wonderful artwork on the front cover by our friend of the show, Sean Longmore. I'd highly recommend it.
Yeah,
people can pick it up wherever you buy books, I guess.
Yeah, published by Polaris. So if you can buy it from them, fantastic. But yeah, it's on Amazon. It can be ordered in all good bookshops if it's not already in there. So yeah, please do go and pick it up. It will give you lots more depth on all of his movies across his career. So if you do, go and buy it. Thank you so much. And thank you guys for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
So for you, Brendan, I mean, overall, you're a big fan now.
I am, which is strange, I think, because of the Bond films that I like on the whole, I prefer a more grounded Bond film, I think.
Right.
Because I really love From Russia With Love and Goldfinger. And they're very different films to this one. But then a lot of
very
Bond
different.
Films are very different to this anyway.
Yeah. Apart from Spy Love Me, which is basically a carbon copy.
The same film. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think everyone across the board knows, they're so confident and comfortable with what they're doing at this point. They've turned it up to 11.
Yeah. That Kobe Doc scene is absolutely superb. Mm-hmm. The final sequence is incredible. The music's great. The script is a bit silly and fantastical in places. But it just does it. I just think this is almost like if you were to describe what a Bond film is like to someone, this is how you sort of would describe it, right? The villain lair and the gadgets and all that sort of stuff.
I mean, absolutely. And it shows from the amount of references and homages that we get moving forward. I mean, there's a whole Simpsons episode based on it.
absolutely.
And a film franchise, Austin Powers, you know, really borrows from this. And Casino Royale 67 as well. It's funny how it's I mean, they choose the... Isn't he cryogenically frozen in 1967 as well? I think he is.
I think he might be, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, they're just... It's full of nods to this film. And this version of Blofeld is the one that gets referenced across all media.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I just think it's so much fun to watch as well. It's really enjoyable.
Well, on that, Brendan, that wraps up our James Bond film specials. We've done all 27 Bond films. It's been quite an epic journey. Interested to listen back to them in release order eventually. Mm. But that means that our next episode will be our XYZ episode, which will be our last episode. We will follow that up with a last episode. looking forward to it. If you want to send in your questions for us or clips or anything that you want to ask us before we finish the show, then please email the show on podcast@jamesbondaz.co.uk. And if people want to find us on social media,
at JamesBondAZ on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter.
And you only live twice. It's done. So it just remains for me to say that the James Bond AZ podcast will return next week.
Ciao. Should have said sayonara.
The James Bond AZ podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe, and leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my underground lair. I have gathered here before me the world's deadliest assassins, and yet each of you has failed to kill Austin Powers. That makes me angry. And when Dr. Evil gets angry, Mr. Bigglesworth gets upset. And when Mr. Bigglesworth gets upset, people die!
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.